So we're here today to talk about hiring SREs. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself and why you should listen to me about why hiring people, since I think it's a little strange for somebody to stand up here and just talk to you about what makes a good hiring team. So I've been in the industry over 10 years at a couple different companies. Right now, I'm the head of Dropbox SRE, where we're responsible for all production systems at Dropbox. For us, this includes the software that runs in and is responsible for deploying to multiple data centers as well as AWS. We support over 300 million users. We store hundreds of petabytes of data. We have tens of petabytes of data in MySQL, and we have multiple petabytes of data warehousing data as well, so lots of data. So that's from the system side. Over the last 2 years, we've also grown the team from 3 people to over 30. We're slated for similar growth this year. Prior to being at Dropbox, I was at YouTube. I was a TL for SRE there from 2008 to 2012. And I started my career at AOL on proxy and cache and streaming systems. So that's me. Let's now kind of like, before we ever hire somebody, we should probably define what we're talking about first. And I've seen this defined a few different ways in my career. I think at Dropbox, we have a great deal of overlap between Google, SRE, and Facebook's production engineering teams. So I think if you heard the keynote last year and if you heard today's keynote, a lot of this will be fairly similar, but I'm going to go through pretty quickly, and I think it is important, though, for us to kind of be on the same page about what type of person and what we're trying to hire for. So things I think that SREs need to be good at. For us, this is understanding fault tolerance. This is if I'm awake at 2 in the morning and a single web server goes down, I don't want to get paged for that. I want, you know, the system to automatically heal. So this is something that SREs need to understand, how to build systems that are fault tolerant, or talk to engineers to get them to build them that way. Second, cascading failures. To me, this is something like if the memcache tier goes down because of an issue, that cascades over to the database systems and the databases suddenly go down as well. Now, if you had built fault-tolerant systems as well, that probably means your databases are like, okay, databases are down, so we should probably promote them. So some system is automatically going to do that, and you're going to have, you know, even a worse scenario. So understanding the interaction between, you know, fault tolerance and cascading failure is very important. I think also SREs have to be good at capacity planning. This is, you know, anything from the macro level to how many servers do we need in a data center, to understanding your individual systems, understanding exactly, you know, your RAM to disk to CPU ratio if you're dealing with something like MySQL, understanding how much network bandwidth you're going to need if you're working with like a CDN. So capacity planning is something you should understand. I think just disaster recovery as well. This is something that I think a lot of organizations don't even think about when they go build an operations team. And disaster recovery and, you know, the testing of disaster recovery is something that, you know, you do have to find people that care about this and understand it, and it's core to the job. At least it is for us. Like, we look for people that can, you know, test the systems and understand exactly how they're going to fail. Performance goes back to capacity planning in some ways. I think it's very important for you to understand how to get the most performance out of the systems. When is it appropriate to do so, and when is it not appropriate to do so? Sometimes it makes sense to, you know, over-optimize for something because there's going to be huge cost savings. Other times it doesn't make sense to do that. So understanding the performance trade-offs is very important. And lastly, I think production systems. I think SREs and PEs have to be the masters of production systems. This means to me being able to speak eloquently about, you know, how they're put together and what are the constraints of the systems. Being able to convey this message in a very concise way to engineering and to the rest of your organization. So that to me is what makes up, you know, from the very core, what SRE is to me when I look for an SRE. So I'm sure there's somebody in this room, or if they're not in this room, you probably know somebody that's like, why do I need this organization in my company? Or why do I need to keep it growing it? Or why do I need another one? Like headcount is always an issue for some teams. So I'm going to try to give you a rubric to kind of talk to either your management teams, or if you've never built an SRE team, why I think it's actually important. So I think I tend to use this metaphor when I talk to SRE candidates at Dropbox and, you know, just people in the industry is at large. I think a product is kind of the tabletop. And you have various teams in your companies that support this tabletop. You have PMs. You need somebody to actually say, this is what the tabletop should look like. This is actually like what we want to build. And they're critical. They're one leg of that, you know, sort of table. Then you have software engineers. These are the people that actually build the product. They're very different, obviously, than SREs or and PMs. They actually build the thing. You have QA, release eng, build eng. This slide is meant to encompass a couple of various teams that are there to support the product as well. And you also have SREs, and these are the teams that ensure the product is running and reliable and is correct. So that's a big part of the job as well. We talked about disaster recovery. I think that's also correctness testing. So if you don't actually build an organization that has teams that are equally impactful and are the best at what they do, you probably end up with a table that looks a little like this. You have great software, but you don't really have, but it's not reliable, for example. Or you have an excellent software engineering team, but not a PM team that's actually able to give you a product that should that's best in class. So I think you really do have to have every team be as impactful as the next in order to get that good balance of what a product is. I think products aren't supported by single people. It's not a single software engineer that's supporting this product. It's not a single PM that comes up with this product. It's not a single SRE that thinks that they're the one up at 2 a.m. making sure it's up all the time. I think the entirety of it is what makes a good organization, and I think this is how I describe how SRE fits into the organization at large. So now that we kind of hopefully have a common sort of framework to think about what SRE is and where it sits in the organization, how do you actually hire your first SRE? And I think if you're in a large organization, a lot of this may seem pretty simple because there's a black box. You just sort of say I need another person, and they just kind of pop out. But I think it is nice to know what happens behind the scenes. And if you are at a smaller organization, you probably play a large part in this. Or if you're thinking about moving to a smaller organization, you're definitely going to play a large part in this. So the way we kind of approach this is, I think the very first thing you have to do is define your rec. And I think it's important to craft your message here. And the reason I think it's very important to craft the message here is that this is the first interaction you're going to have with a candidate, whether it's them reading it on the website or them being told this from a recruiter. And I think it's important to tailor this message. The message should be tailored for what you're trying to attract for that stage of your company. Talent is going to be different across the years of the company and the maturity of the company. And so you want to make sure this message is tailored correctly for what you're looking for. So I'm going to use three examples. Obviously, it's probably going to be the three Dropbox, Facebook, and Google as kind of the examples. I think we're in three different stages of development of where our organizations are. So for us, the message obviously we're trying to get across here is that you'll be part of the infrastructure team. We're not building a separate operations organization. We have a team that's very core to engineering, and it's part of engineering, but with a focus on infrastructure at this point. Facebook, for example, I think theirs, and these are snippets from the entire recs, but Facebook seems to be trying to get across that you work across the entirety of engineering. You're working with product teams, you're working with infrastructure teams. I think we heard Pedro talk about this a little this morning, how they're working on, how do we get products into production faster when they're really early stage products. And I think this kind of captures that message of what they're trying to build there. And you have Google. Google's is it's very different than all the rest. I think they're trying to convey that you'll work on a team that's very different than every other team in the industry. If you heard Ben Trainor's talk last year, they are probably much farther along in sort of the curve of where SRE organizations are than both us or Facebook. And I think they're trying to convey that here as well. So that to me, you have your rec, you said, okay, this is what we're going to go hire for. But what you haven't done is define the criteria you care about. We talked about the principles of what makes a good SRE, and I think those principles are consistent whether you're in early stage, mid stage, late stage. The principles are the same, but the criteria you want to evaluate for is different. And I also don't think this criteria is the same as the interview questions. The questions, are built from the criteria you're looking to evaluate on. Also, at this point, you probably either don't have SREs hired, or you either have SREs hired and there's very few, or you don't have any SREs hired at all, and so you have this classic kind of chicken and egg problem. So I guess for the next sort of portion, we're going to talk about what makes a good starting recipe for sort of the mid-early stage SRE organizations. So I think software skills is an absolute must. I don't think that at any stage in a company today you can hire an engineer without software skills. I do think that there is a significant difference between SREs and SWEs when it comes to development and coding. This may be contentious, but I think I go back to also Pedro's keynote this morning. I think he touched on this a little bit as well. I think both teams are very capable of building equally complex systems. I think the critical difference is that with a SWE versus an SRE, SREs are really, really, really good at building large, complex systems quickly, but they're inevitably brittle. Software engineers are good at building really, really large, complex, scalable systems that aren't as brittle, but they may not do it as quickly, and there's also a much more rigorous development practice around it. I think SREs, you know, there's a big time constraint when you're working in production that you have to get things out, and that probably contributes a little to it, but I do think there's substantial difference, and I think this goes into sort of the evaluation phase, and we'll talk about that when I get into sort of the implementation of how you actually evaluate this. So systems and networks, absolutely required. I kind of break this down into a couple different ways. The first, general Linux system administration skills. I think this is what we all look for as kind of table stakes as well. This is anything to do with like provisioning, how does AWS work? What are the very basics that you do to operate, you know, within the production environment? This, most people probably have these if they're coming in for the interview, that you don't need super deep ones, I don't think, when you start working at scale. The sort of problems you start working at scale can tend to be a little different, but you should have good fundamentals in Linux system administration, or Windows if you're working at Microsoft, or, you know, whatever the basic sort of OS that you have, that you're hiring for is. The next is low-level systems knowledge. And notice I don't put sort of Linux on this, or I don't put Windows on this, or anything like that. This to me is the ability to talk in detail about, and I don't want to say low-level systems, but an example is probably more apt here. If you had an NFS mount, say like a NetApp, and you wanted to store lots of thumbnails on it and then serve these at a very high QPS, like why would that not be a great idea? Like being able to understand why that's the case and then talk about like how this actually comes about and like why, you know, maybe coming up with a different storage system might be better for your thumbnailing system. And then, in general, do you know how all these things are put together? And I touched on this earlier with sort of like the production systems. I think it's very important that you can talk eloquently about how the systems are put together and explain the constraints to the rest of engineering. Engineers, in general, don't want to go build systems that don't conform to the constraints, but if you don't tell them and you can't adequately explain them to them, they will go build something and then it'll try to shove it into production and it just won't work. So you should be able to talk and be able to convey this message. The next sort of thing in the evaluation sort of criteria that we're looking for is architecture. To me, without getting into architecture too deeply here, because we'll do this a little bit later, this is talking about trade-offs. No system is perfect. No system is infinitely scalable, durable, or available. But there are things you're going to do when you build this system, and you're going to make trade-offs between them. And you need to be able to explain why you made that trade-off. Just, you know, saying I'm going to go do this isn't good enough. You need to actually be able to express why that is. I think as a side note, this typically requires substantial real-world knowledge. I think when we go to evaluate, you know, a recent college grad or a new college grad, talking about architecture is not necessarily the most interesting thing with them. I actually lean more on the software skills again. I think that's where they're coming from. That's the background they have. So pushing more on algorithms and things like that from the software side is probably more apt when you have a college grad. So troubleshooting. I think this is also another piece of criteria you have to have. This to me means, can you think logically? Can you get from point A to point B to point C without going to C and then coming back to B? There's lots of ways you can test this. And we'll talk about that, like I said, in the sort of implementation phase of the criteria. Next is depth of knowledge you can get out of troubleshooting. If you have a very, you know, a senior person doing this interview process, you can actually go get them to, you know, play a yes-no terminal with a candidate and see how deep the candidate can go. You can push them in different directions. See, you know, if the candidate's, you know, going into DNS, can you go super deep in DNS? Can you go super deep in networking? Everybody has different spikes, and, you know, I like the troubleshooting question to see, like, where those spikes are. The last is soft skills. I think this is absolutely critical for SREs in general engineers. I'm not going to talk too much in detail about evaluating them because it can be tricky, and it's really going to be dependent on the organization that you have. But I think they're very important. So the first of the two that I think are like mission critical, first is customer service. And this does not mean I'm talking about like a ticket-driven organization. It means that you have the ability to go interface and talk to other teams, and they can have the ability to come and interface with you. I don't think, you know, the traditional bastard operator from hell sort of mentality, I think that it's no longer applicable in the industry. I think if you're finding those people, they aren't the best people. And so this to me is like something you have to tease out in the interview process. I think everybody is a customer of someone else, and you just generally have to be good at that. The next is prioritization. And I think this, above almost everything else besides software, is probably the most critical thing that you can get out of an interview. I can take any engineer in this room and clone you. And I touch one of you with a prioritization wand. That engineer will be 10 times better than the other engineer every single time. This is true in every single setting I've ever seen. And I think this is one of the most important things you can tease out of the interview. Some people may argue that if your organization is larger, you know, infinite resources, prioritization is not as important. I would still say, though, in like times of crisis, like prioritization is still much more important than any other skill you can have. It's critical. I think you just have to be able to find a way to evaluate this as part of the interview, and I think it's something that we always look for in the criteria when we're hiring. Okay, so now we know what we want to hire for, or like at least the criteria we're looking for. How do we get these people in the door and close them? The market is pretty competitive, and I think you have to have a good framework for doing this. It's not something you can just kind of do ad hoc. You can't just say, I'm going to go hire people. You have to actually come up with a rubric that makes sense to bring people in the door and get them from stage one to stage two to stage three. There's probably some people in this room that are involved in organizations where they don't have to do this as much anymore, but I do think it's important to have empathy for your recruiting teams, your sourcing teams, et cetera. So I do think it's important, so I do want to cover this. And if you're going to leave one of those organizations and join a smaller company, you're definitely going to have to understand this. And it's probably one of the most important things as an early employee at a company, a hiring manager at a company, that you can understand. So setting up and filling your funnel. This is literally how you ensure you keep your engineers busy with interviews, as much as they may hate them. So you just have to do this. I don't think there's a good way to like describe this other than the funnel. This is kind of how I think about it. You source people, you convince them to come interview, you may do a phone screen, you evaluate them, you make an offer, and hopefully they accept that offer. This funnel should be metrics driven. You always want to know how many people are passing from each phase of the funnel to the next phase of the funnel. You want to know exactly the percentage of people that you make an offer to and then accept. You want to know exactly how many people you're able to source and get, you know, in the door to actually interview. If you don't know those things, you don't know which part of the funnel to tweak and which part of the funnel you actually need to put, you know, that you need to double down on. It's just very important. Like anything else you do in operations, you have to be metrics driven. This is just one other place that it's very important to be. And it may seem counterintuitive because this is much more of a soft skill area, but you do need the metrics here. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to target sort of the three major stages of the pipeline. And obviously each phase can be broken down further and further and further, but I think these are the most interesting phases to talk about when you're hiring somebody. So the first is sourcing. You've probably all heard about the sourcing role. This is, you know, that person that spams you on LinkedIn or sends you all this email on LinkedIn. I actually think that if you are getting those emails and it's from a good sourcer, it's truly because they believe the opportunity that they're offering you is better than the opportunity you currently have. And I think if you're a hiring manager and you're sending these emails, you definitely should believe that. If you're not believing that, I guarantee you it will come through in the emails. People will not realize that like you truly believe that this is the place they should be at. So I think if you go in with that mindset when you're, you know, sourcing people, you'll be successful at this. So what are the major ways for sourcing? Obviously, I think the number one and only way you can actually truly bring great people in is use your existing employees for referrals. Level one referrals for, you know, somebody you've worked with closely are the best people you'll probably ever work with again. I can say that my team, I think, I'm trying to count off the top of my head, but definitely over a quarter of the team is people that I have worked with either at AOL or at Google/YouTube for multiple years. And they've brought in people they have then worked with at, you know, Google or YouTube or various other companies. And I think it is the number one way you do this. There is no other way to do it. You can do LinkedIn, you can do meetups, you can go to conferences. The hit rate is obviously much lower. The hit rate for, you know, like referrals where people know them is going to be much, much higher. And the last is the email people. You do have to do the sourcing. You have to go and find these people and you have to contact them. If you think you're too good for it, you're not. Like, it is literally the only way you're going to make this work. It is elbow grease. It is the thing you have to do to build teams. I think the single greatest thing you can do for your team is help your team hire a new engineer. They will be force multipliers. If you don't bring in new people, the team will stagnate. You need new ideas. You need to constantly fill this and like bring in new people that have different ways of thinking. So at this point, we've got a list of engineers that we think we are going to bring in and we're going to talk to and we're going to actually have join our company. But guess what? They actually don't want to join your company yet. They have no desire to. They're just kind of like, okay, yeah, this person emailed me. That's nice. Yeah, I emailed you back. Yes. It's nice to meet you. Nice to know I'm wanted, blah, blah, blah. So now you have to sell them to actually come in an interview. That's actually the biggest, and I think this is actually the most important part of the entire process. I think you can get the candidate to accept the job here before they even interview. If you can do that, the rest of the process is super easy. Then it's just evaluation, and it's, you know, making an offer. And you don't have to do anything post that. I think it's also the hardest. So first, I think this is just like being a manager or being, you know, like a lead in any other circumstance. You have to take notes about people. You have to understand what motivates them. You have to understand what they're looking for. It's not a short process in some cases. You actually have to put in the work here and keep track of what you've talked about, how they're thinking about the problem, what are the things they're motivated by. Some people it's money, some people it's impact, some people it's role. Knowing exactly how that is and tailoring the message to them is super critical. Knowing this and having this down now also makes the closing part of the candidate process easier as well. The second part to this is make a real human connection. Don't read off a script. You need to figure out what makes someone tick. You need to be able to like make that connection with them. Think of it this way. Every single person has a job that you're probably looking for to hire. They're spending 39 hours, if they're working 40 hours a week, with their company and their coworkers. That's a deeper connection you're ever going to get than you're ever going to have with them in a one-hour chat. So if you aren't able to like figure out what motivates them in that 1 hour, I guarantee you they're not going to come join you. Like it's the most important thing you can do. This is why I think this is also the hardest phase, because you have like this 1 to 2 hour like window to actually get in and like convince them that you have a job that they're going to like more than their current job. And I will say this can take months or even years in some cases, but it's worth it. This goes back to elbow grease. Like, you have to revisit these people. Not everybody will find that they're a fit for your company at the stage your company's in. But that doesn't mean in 6 months from now they won't actually find that that's the case. I definitely know that has been the case for me, myself included. Like, I've looked at companies and I've said, this is not the right place for me. And I've come back later and said, okay, this is. And there's definitely people on my team that have done the same thing as well. So put in the work for sourcing and like maintaining these contacts with these people. That is the only way you actually are going to grow the team. So at this point, we've, you know, convinced somebody to come interview or at least phone screen. So now we've talked about the evaluation criteria, because we wanted to go into the interview process with kind of everybody on the same footing and understand exactly what we're looking for. So now we want to actually implement that. And so this is the interview process. This is probably what you guys all are most interested in, like, how do we think about interviewing and what is the criteria like we're using to evaluate this in the interview process? What is the interview structured like? So the methodology that we've kind of come up with, and I think this is pretty similar to Facebook and Google as well, is there's three main components to it: coding, architecture, and troubleshooting. I think number one, coding is the most important thing you can possibly do. It's an absolute must. I think you can implement this in a couple ways. There's obviously coding on the whiteboard. It's probably the de facto standard in Silicon Valley right now. Is, you know, you come in and you're given some problem and you're asked to code this on a whiteboard. Second is laptop, and the third is kind of like take-home test. You know, you're given some code to take home and write this and submit it back. I think it's non-negotiable that you pass this. I think that you have to get past the coding portion in order to be successful at most organizations that are at scale or to kind of have that trajectory through the organization. So here's a really contrived example of what could be an okay interview question in some circumstances. I don't think it's actually great, but for the purpose of this example, we can kind of dive into a little bit. So build a script that aggregates status codes over a 1 minute interval for Apache log files in the common log format. Okay, super simple. It should not, you know, it's a couple lines of code. But I think you can, you know, change the constraints and start talking about this in different ways that actually test and get more than you thought about, more info about the candidate than you thought. So I bet you didn't think you could actually test systems and networks with this question. So you come up with the, you know, basic, you know, here's how I'm going to parse the log file. But what if we add constraints like, okay, the log files are actually on NFS and they're massively large and you only have 500 megs of RAM on your web server. How would you build this program then? Most people's naive example would probably do something like read lines and just read the whole file into memory. You can start to think about like, okay, what are the impacts of the system of systems and networks on this problem, and start to dive a little deeper and get more out of more out of the interview than you possibly thought. It's more than just, you know, the 5 minute I wrote this code on the board. I also think you can get logical thinking out of this. This one's pretty obvious. I think, you know, seeing how somebody approaches the problem, if they didn't ask the questions to start with, how big is the log file? Am I running this on the server is the server still processing requests? Is this log file complete or is this log file still being written to? Should the program output anything? My example didn't ask you to actually output anything or do anything. So I've seen a lot of people come in and write a bunch of code on the board and say like, okay, and then I printed all the lines. We didn't ever ask you to print any of the lines. Maybe that's a question, you know, you should ask. Like these are the things that I think from the interviewer's side where we're saying like, okay, how is this person thinking about the problem? Is there attention to detail in the problem? Do they understand are they understanding exactly what we're getting at? Adapting to pressure. I think coding can also kind of, you know, give you this sense of like, can they adapt? Like we were saying, we can change the constraints of the problem. How is it different? If the candidate didn't ask you to qualify anything or, you know, go give you more information about the problem, I guarantee you I'll change the problem in such a way that makes them have written 20 lines of code on the board, change the problem a little bit, or, you know, give them a little more information, and they're going to have to refactor that code. So we can see how they adapt and how they are able to respond to that. This, for me, for SREs, goes really core to, you know, can they respond to on-call? So I think then the last one is obviously communication skills. Can the candidate convey complex ideas without getting frustrated? You can think of it in a harder sort of like coding question that's more algorithmic. You may want them to explain the algorithm to you. They should be able to do this in a way that's actually understandable. I think it's very frustrating when there's a lot of hand waving and there's not a lot of good information being presented. And so I think having that, the coding interview portion can actually test this as well. I think a lot of people forget that coding is a lot more than just coding because you can get a lot out of that interview in and of itself. Architecture. This one's always interesting. We're going to start kind of like in the same way we talked about with the coding question is if we said design a video website or design a video site, not even a website, just design a video site. I think there's two classes of candidates. The first is going to do this. They're going to come in. They're going to start with a blank whiteboard. They're going to tell you they have a load balancer. They're going to tell you they have a web server. And that web server puts things in a database and stores video files to disk. And you ask, you know, this is, and they're going to say, this is what we did at my last company. This is pretty simple. This is all I really need to do to, you know, serve a website. And they may throw a CDN in there as well and say, like, okay, it's video, so we should put this on a CDN. We have to distribute to the world, and we want to, you know, make it low latency. To me, that's not at all like a great approach to start this question. I think you do need to get more information. I think there's a lot of things you can ask here. Like, what's the purpose of this website? Is this, are we building YouTube or are we building Netflix? They're completely different problems. How many monthly uniques are there going to be on the web for this site? You know, if it's a low QPS website and, you know, it's an internal thing, maybe using a NetApp is appropriate because we're going to throw money at the problem as opposed to engineer a solution. Is there a sharing model? Are we sharing videos between people? That changes the complexity of the problem like drastically. How does a sharing model work? Do there need to be ACLs on the videos? These are all problems that I think really change the architecture that you're going to go to build. And so understanding the constraints of the question, understanding exactly what the question is getting at is very important. And this allows you, these questions allow you to talk about trade-offs, right? UGC site versus Netflix. I think they're very different problems. You can kind of talk about the bounded nature of sort of the amount of video that Netflix will see versus like sort of the unbounded nature of YouTube. But on the other hand, I guarantee you YouTube is going to have lower watch times than Netflix is going to have. So that's going to change sort of your characteristics of how you build some of the streaming services. These are all things that you need that you can talk about during the architecture question. And I think it's much more than just, you know, getting to the whiteboard and like drawing a bunch of boxes on the board. You have to go like one or two levels deeper and understand actually fundamentally what you're trying to build. This is my tip for you all for the architecture question. Average engineers will overdesign. In every single case I've ever seen this question asked, an average engineer overdesigns this question almost immediately. You end up with caching layers, you end up with streaming layers. Like it just becomes like the spirals out of control boxes on the whiteboard. And I think there's a great talk that was given from YouTube a long time ago about like the Tao of YouTube, and it was all about like keeping it simple. I think that is the most important thing you can do is actually keep it simple. If you can keep your architecture simple and flexible, you can expand as the site as needed. And so that's the other thing that I try to tease out of this is like, are they building something super complex or are they building something that's actually going to be flexible and allow them to adapt with like the changing of business needs? So troubleshooting. This is the last sort of component of the interview process, you know, that I've seen done and that we like to use. Questions here tend to be like, how would you diagnose a slow MySQL server? How would you diagnose a slow web server? It's an open-ended question. You can kind of allow your candidate to go deeper and deeper and deeper. If you have a senior engineer that, you know, kind of, hopefully you've all seen this chart. This is an awesome chart, by the way. If you haven't seen this, the link is in here on the bottom. You can't see it on the board, but we actually have this printed out, and I think this is like one of the best references we've had for troubleshooting questions. You can kind of use this, and you know, if they can reason for why the MySQL server is slow from first principles and actually use these tools to get at why it's slow, I guarantee you they're going to be successful. Yeah, you should definitely print this out, and like every single operations team should have this hung somewhere in there, you know, have it hung somewhere. I think it's one of the coolest charts I've seen in a long time. So now you've evaluated your candidate, right? You can they use these tools? Can they do these things? I think good candidates do troubleshoot from first principles. They're able to not just say, I've seen this before, but they're able to, you know, take a tool and understand how that tool works and dive deeper and deeper and deeper into the stack until they come to like the root cause. They're probably the ones that can design MySQL or design portions of it as opposed to the ones that can just run it. So with that said, deciding to hire. These are my tips for how you decide to hire somebody. And a lot of teams and organizations do this in different ways. I think the most important thing is write down your thoughts. After the interview, write them down. Even if your company doesn't have a formal process around writing these down, write them down. I cannot express how many times I have left an interview saying, yes, we're gonna hire this person, or no, we're not gonna hire this person, based on like my initial impression. I've written down what I actually thought, and I've said, wow, like that person actually knew this substantially deeper than I thought they did. I looked at the notes that I had taken and, you know, I kind of synthesized this and I said, okay, we should hire this person. Or this person just like blew me away in terms of like their charisma, but actually had no substance. And so I left the room thinking, okay, wow, like that was a great interview. He talked to me the whole time. He talked about all these great things. And then you realize he didn't actually implement anything on the board. Like you had a coding question, he wrote zero code, but he was able to talk to you about this, the whole problem. And so writing down your thoughts allows you to like kind of put yourself in a mental place where you draw a conclusion. You should have a rubric that everybody understands. Everybody that's evaluating the candidate should understand exactly what you're trying to evaluate for and how the questions are written, what are the questions designed to test. I have some engineers that always say, you know, they'll say no, but it's a qualified no. They're saying no based on the question that I asked. I know nothing else about the scenario. All I can say no is about what I know, or about like the question I tested. And so I think that's actually really important that, you know, you're basically you can only test what you're evaluating for. You can't actually know, you know, how he did in the troubleshooting question if you're asking a coding question. So the rubric is very important. Like if everybody has their role and their job for the interview, understanding what your role was and what your job was in the interview is like critical. Don't try and fit someone into a role you didn't evaluate for. That person, you know, if you need to reevaluate them, do that. You shouldn't, you know, interview, if you interview an SRE and, you know, they blow you away in coding, don't make them a SWE though, just because they blew you away in the coding component of the SRE interview. Like, that doesn't make any sense. You had two other components to the interview that may not be on the SWE loop, and software engineers may never have, like, touched this. So I think it's very important to actually evaluate and then fit the person to the role you evaluated them for. You should never try to, you know, say, oh, well, we'll make up a role for this person because we really like this person. You know, you should then, you know, from first principles say, like, we need to have a role that does X, Y, or Z. What is the evaluation criteria? And then either reapply, you know, the thoughts that you've written down and say, like, okay, let's do it with this criteria, or just don't hire them. Like, it's a risk if you hired them and you didn't evaluate them for that role. You should have an impartial moderator. I think that's very critical. Having the hiring manager be the person that is like moderating the discussion is a bad idea. They're incentivized to always hire that person. There is no incentive not to hire that person. Small places, this can be hard, but at least remove yourself from the conversation and allow the people that did the interview to, you know, to actually talk about it without interjecting. I think it's important to ensure there's consensus as well. Teams, the people that interview the candidate should all be in agreement. I think it's very important for them to be in agreement. It's okay if they have to, it takes them a while to come to that, but nobody should leave the room or, you know, think we're hiring somebody that, you know, that they didn't feel is a fit. Or at least they should understand where everyone else is coming from and be willing to take that risk. And the last is, like, I think it's important, especially early on, to think about what is the curve. And what do I mean by that? What is the acceleration of the candidate? Is the candidate, like, so in the black line, I think this is an extreme performer, someone that doesn't slow down. They're able to start and they're able to ramp up very quickly. And they're able to go, you know, they're able to produce immediately. And their trajectory seems, like, unbounded in some sense. I think then there's a quick growth, which is a gray. You know, you kind of have this, like, really fast acceleration the first couple of months into a company, but you taper out. Like, which is not bad. It's just like, this is just the sort of curves that people have when they join companies. And then the blue is sort of like a slower ramp, but accelerates very quickly. And you want to make sure these all are compensating. Like, you don't want to have all quick, you know, extremely quick acceleration people, and then, you know, have them all slow down at the same time. You don't want to have, you know, a team of all, you know, 10Xers, black sort of line, like, candidates isn't going to make the best team either. You want to have some diversity here. You want to, like, understand how people are going to fit into your teams. So I think this is a very important discussion point, like, when you're looking at, like, how is this person going to fit into my organization? So if you've done all this, you're then moving on to the next phase, which is making an offer and closing the candidate. And if you did your job earlier, this should be completely easy. If you spent the time selling the candidate in the sort of the pre-sell, you understood what they cared about during the interview process, you had a very, you know, meaningful, thoughtful discussion about them when you're making the offer, it should be pretty easy at this point. I am actually not going to go into much more detail here. If you want to know, like, my secrets, I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards, but, like, I don't want you guys to all go steal engineers away from me, so I'm not going to give you any more secrets on closing here. But that's all I've got for hiring SREs and, like, hiring in general. If you guys have questions, I'm happy to take them now.
So you mentioned everyone should know the rubric, and there was actually a recent article I was published about hiring engineers and mm-hmm. actually being transparent. Do you feel that the candidate should know the rubric that they're being judged under?
Yeah. I mean, I think the candidate should know, like, exactly what they're walking into on day one. I think we send out sort of, I know on the software side, we say, you know, this is going to be a heavy, intensive coding interview. Here are the things we're going to do. I think the criteria differs. Like, what the bar is for, like, what you're evaluating on, I don't think they need to know. But they should know, like, what the process is. I think it makes it less scary when you go in. Yeah. Sorry, the question was, like, should they know the rubric? So the question is, where do you find impartial moderators? They can be other teams. They can be recruiters. It typically works best when it's another engineer because they can kind of they know exactly what you're kind of looking for. Given that SRE is so specialized, what we've tended to do is have other SREs do it that weren't involved in the interview loop. Obviously, this is a challenge if you have a small team. But you can always train someone up, you know, a software engineer up to be able to do this. It's more about moderation. It's less about actually knowing what they're like. Knowing where the bar is and being able to evaluate that as opposed to, you know, actually making a decision, yes and no. The group usually comes to a consensus. This person just drives to it. Yep.
So you said you'd like to have some diversity around the ramp.
Mm-hmm. So how do I quantify the diversity around the ramp before you hire them? It's hard, but I would say in this market today, I think it's important to have that diversity. If you have three college grads all starting at the same time and they're all going to do the same thing, it's kind of hard. That's the only place I've seen it today. Industry hires are so hard to get that, like, I haven't had to worry about that problem from the sense of, like, we have five industry people all starting on Tuesday. Like, what's their ramp going to be? I think it's also – the other reason I say that is I think it plays in longer term in the team growth as well, because – you can probably apply that ramp to how they think about projects as well, right? So, like, if you have a new project coming online, you probably want somebody that ramps very quickly as opposed to somebody that takes much longer time if you're trying to deploy to production quickly. So I think that also kind of is the reason I think it's important to understand that. Some engineers can pick up and like just figure out code or figure out the problem like in seconds, and other engineers need a week to digest it, but they end up in the same place, and it's equally as valuable depending on sort of the stage and what you're doing. Yep. How do you avoid a bias in the hiring decision? The hiring manager's not, what do you mean by bias? The hiring manager shouldn't be part of it, so. Yeah. We bring in people outside of the team as well. For example, if we're starting a new office, we try to have some people from new offices and old offices evaluate them. So there is a little, like, so that bias isn't there, that you're just getting another person that's exactly the same like the people in the office. It's a good question. I think it is hard to do. I think it's, we have seen that we do, like, we will skew towards like hiring the same type of profile over and over. We've tried to put in some gates and bumpers around that just by saying like, okay, we're gonna bring in a moderator from someplace else, or we're gonna have somebody else look at this, or we'll have, you know, someone that's orthogonal to the problem do what we call like an all-around interview for that person to see what type of personality they actually have. So I think that's one way you can compensate for it. It is hard. I mean, with smaller teams, I think it's, smaller teams, I would actually say it might be okay to err a little bit on that, because it makes the team grow quicker in terms of like bonding as well. But at some point, you do have to start to like bring in the new ideas. So the question is around metrics. How do you figure out if the candidate, like basically, is the candidate the right fit, or are there other candidates that would be fit? Right now we've been erring on the side of the false positive, like meaning like we didn't hire them, I think is actually okay. What I don't want is the person that we hire that's actually not a fit. So we have revisited and we have gone back through, and this is why some of this is like the elbow grease section as well. Like, you may have somebody that you don't hire that actually is a fit, just, and you know, eventually you may come back around to them and the team may be more mature and able to evaluate better. We are early enough in our life cycle, we haven't had to think like too concretely about that. I have seen it in other organizations where like they are evaluating that based on performance criteria of the candidate throughout like their life cycle of the company, and then going back to see if that matches up with sort of the interview evaluation criteria. Obviously for exits and things like that, you always want to revisit and see and make sure that like, hey, did we actually evaluate this person the correct way? Was it all yeses, but it should have been a no, that sort of thing. For us right now, it's kind of like, we don't have a lot of data on it, but I think it's an important question to think about. What do you mean by like, so the contentious part is having an external recruiter like find them, or having all the skills? No. So, I see what you're saying. I don't necessarily think it is. I mean, I think the way I look at the interview process is like, it's much more, do they understand things? Like, if there's like a why, a how, and a what. You know, there's people that can do the what, which is like what you're talking about, like what is the NoSQL that they actually know how to administrate? Like, how is like, why would you use this NoSQL database? And then why is NoSQL from first principles, like why do you need this in the industry to start with? And like, can they talk about that? And can they actually, you know, building it, like if they could build me a NoSQL storage system, like, okay, fine. Like, I don't actually care that, you know, you listed this other NoSQL system. I think it's much more about like the candidate's, you know, interview process, and like, it's the approach they're taking as opposed to like yes or no, they know this individual technology. I actually, to college grads, like I don't think there's probably that many in the room, but in terms of like recent college grads, I think that when they approach us at career fairs and they say like, oh, I know Java or I know Python, It's the same sort of thing. It's not that important. It's about, you know, can you apply the principles you learned, and like, can you learn a new language? Like, if you know Java, you should be able to pick up Python. If you know Python, you should be able to pick up, you know, Ruby. And then it's sort of the ramp rate. How fast can you do that? I think it's a so the difference is the question is like around differences between SWE and SRE and sort of the coding. I think it's a personality trait, time constraints. I think large organizations at Google, like, there's very little from what I've seen. It's a very blurry line in some cases. I think it is time constraints. I think that the personality tends to be much more, I think Pedro actually talked about this morning a little bit too, like how the personality trait is like much more like, I want to go look at everything and touch everything and like work on everything. And when that happens, you tend to, you know, build larger, complex, more brittle systems, in my opinion, which is not bad. It's just, it is a fact of life to some degree. And it just means that, you know, they're the ones that are able to like get things up and off the ground running much quicker in a lot of cases. It's a trade-off. Yep.
So you mentioned
earlier that is the question is average engineers over engineer, and so should you steer them in the correct direction? I do think you have to, it's an art form, right? Like steering them in the correct direction is an art form. It's difficult because they may, like, I think a lot of it is understanding like what the question is even asking, and you can try to steer them towards that, but if they're coming back to still, you know, like, this is what you do it, this is how you just, like, this is all you have to build, I think it's very difficult to steer them towards the questions that they need to be thinking about and the trade-offs. A lot of times we'll use keywords like, what is the trade-off you're making between using the NetApp versus HDFS? What are the performance characteristics differences? Like, why would you use one versus the other? We do try to steer them. I mean, it's challenging though. Yep.
Do you do any behavioral
evaluation? So, how have you done XYZ? How are you telling me the rules? Yes. So the question is on behavioral sort of evaluation. We actually, in general, we do have like what we have is like we call an all around interview, which is much more geared towards that. I think for us, we've been able to tease that out from the general sort of like question and answer sort of portions of it. There are some candidates where like, yes, that that sort of like behavioral and spending 45 minutes is very critical. I think this is also where the pre-sell and the sourcing can also come into play. You hopefully can tell if this is gonna be a candidate that you wanna apply that rubric to coming into that. Sometimes it's very important to do that. And so you just upfront say like, we wanna evaluate the behavioral aspects of this candidate more so than the technical aspects, because, you know, if it's a first order referral, you may have super strong signal on technical, but, you know, that person may say, I like working with that person, but it wasn't the favorite person I worked with. And so you wanna actually evaluate that as opposed to just like, you know, their pure software skills or their pure architecture skills. They may already have that, and you already have that signal. The signal you're trying to get is on the behavioral side and how they'll fit in with the team. So yes, you should do it. Yep. Train and calibrate interviewers. So the question is around calibrating and training interviewers. For the most part, what we do is we have them shadow. We have them then do a reverse shadow where they do the interview. Then the interview, the person doing the reverse shadow is, you know, interviewing the candidate, and then they have an evaluation written by the person shadowing them, which should have been the same. They flip-flop roles, essentially. And there's discussion around that. For us, given that, you know, we're 30, 35 people, it's kind of easy for us to kind of loop back around and give very, like, in-person feedback and, like, talk through that all without having to, like, you know, go through the massive process engine of larger organizations for that. I'll be interested to see it for us, like, how it scales. It's worked pretty well. The other one is I do try to pay attention to sort of like all the interviews across the company, and it's like to say calibrated for where like the rest of the company is calibrated in their organizations. And then from the standpoint of like software, we do have SREs that go and do software engineering interviews or will shadow software engineering interviews so that they know where the calibration is on the software side as well. So I think it is very important actually to be cross-trained on this. Other questions? Yep.
You mentioned
No, not language specific. This is just like, sorry, it's my default to like I do Python. Dropbox is heavily Python and Go, so like that's the, when I think about it and we're talking about it, it's just Python, but you can write in any language. We've had people do interviews in Go, we've had them do it in like Ruby, Java, C++, like it's whatever you want to do. It helps when you have interviewers that can write the language too, but for the most part, like most people, at least that I work with, are able to like kind of go through that. Even if it's not the language you're familiar with, they can at least get through the interview with it. Yeah, not language specific at all, though. Last one, I think. Skilled versus, excuse me? How do you trade off skill versus attitude? I personally think small scale attitude is more important. Because you won't be able to grow the team because people won't want to work for that person, so it's going to be much harder to hire people into the organization at all. I think if they're that skilled, you know, there are exceptions to the rule. I think then it's a conversation with the team, with sort of like the organization as a whole, if they are that much of a rock star. But I think the number of like that caliber rock star are so far and few between that that's a conversation you're probably having once every couple of years. It's not a conversation you should be having every single time. Anybody else? That's it. Thank you.